Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. As Pope Benedict XVI prepares to visit the town of St. Francis of Assisi this weekend, we hear a little about who the much-loved saint was and about the incredible legacy he has left. We hear about an event here in Rome geared to raise awareness towards appreciating local crops with the ultimate aim of conserving biodiversity. And Father Jim Brand talks to those who are sad or depressed, reminding them that God is always there. Pope Benedict XVI will travel to the Umbrian town of Assisi on Sunday as part of the 800th anniversary celebrations of the conversion of St. Francis. The Pope will make a tour of the town's magnificent basilicas. He will preside over Mass in the Basilica of St. Francis, and he will hold meetings with the clergy and with religious during the afternoon. Now, many are the perspectives one can take when outlining a portrait of the little poor man of Assisi and of the incredible legacy he has left. I spoke to Franciscan friar Joe Rosansky, director of the Franciscan Office for Justice and Peace in the Integrity of Creation. First of all, I asked, who was St. Francis?
For me, Francis was a person of his times. You know, if you look and see the way that Francis lived and responded to what was going on around him, I think that in many ways he was very modern in the sense that he read what was going on around him. He understood, maybe not, I'm sure he didn't understand all the details, but he saw going on around him the huge changes in society. And he responded to them. His choice of poverty, for sure, was a spiritual choice. He chose it because Jesus also chose to be poor, you know, chose to come to earth, etc., etc. But Francis also gave up his position. They were part of the Nouveau Riche, his family. His father was a cloth merchant, but Francis gave that up and decided on a life of poverty, of extreme poverty. As a matter of fact, that was one of his big discussions with the church. You know, the church felt that that wasn't possible to live that kind of a life of poverty. And Francis, and also Claire, you know, Claire, she followed in the footsteps of Francis. They both insisted that this was not only possible, but it was something that should be done because it was following more closely in the footsteps of Jesus. So I would say that, you know, Francis was responding to what he saw around him, the extreme poverty of many people. He was looking to them and also looking to this idea of living spiritually in the footsteps of Jesus.
And all Franciscans still do just that, follow in the footsteps of Jesus and of Francis, of course. And one of the vows they take to be able to do this is the vow of poverty. What sense, I asked Brother Joe, does such a vow have in today's world?
That's actually a very good question. We're in the process of putting together a resource booklet for the friars around the world, which will deal with, we have general constitutions, and chapter 4 of the general constitutions deals with minority. And among other things, it's where the constitutions deal with the question that you just asked about poverty. And I think it is something that we need to ask ourselves, you know, how do we live our vow today? And I would say that at the minimum, we need to put our resources at the beck and call of a world that really needs them. I think we have a very good, solid message. The message of Francis is very alive for today. And I think that we, as followers of Francis today, need to look at how we might be able to live those vows in a way where we challenge our world to be different. I mean, when we look around and see all the difficulties with poverty, with hunger, with so many problems, it would seem that our vow would encourage us strongly in that direction to be involved in the social problems of our world.
As I said at the beginning, there are so many different aspects regarding the Franciscan mission and charism. It could take days to even begin to do it justice. So I asked Brother Rosansky, who's been a friar for over 30 years, to give me one last reflection on the legacy of the Poverello of Assisi.
After 800 years, the spirit of Francis is still very alive, and he stood for certain things that, you know, you said earlier about how that Francis is your favorite saint, and most people know about Francis, and that's not only Catholics, but non-Catholics too. And many people just love him because of what they see him standing for.
He's gentle.
Exactly, because he never jumped on top of people to tell them how they should be. What he did, though, he lived that which he believed, and in the integrity of his life, he invited people to be like he was. And it just seems to me that we need a little bit more of that in our world today. It seems like we're usually whacking one another over the head with different ideas or different notions or how people should be. You know, I think we need to remember with Francis that, first of all, we need to be that which we would like other people to be also. And I think that the life of Francis, you know, after these 800 years looking back at him, that his life was an invitation. One of the things that I really liked about Francis, he said, preach sometimes with words, you know, but mostly with your life. Preach with your life, and if you need to, use words. And it just seems to me that really good advice for all of us. You know, if we want something to happen, we need to show people that it's good and that it's important and that it would make a difference in, you know, for us and for our world. And I think that's the kind of example that Francis offers us.
Many of you may know that Rome is home to a large organization called FAO. It's the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, and it leads international efforts to defeat hunger. That's an ambitious mandate for sure, but it fulfills its mission by acting as a forum where nations and a variety of organizations can meet to negotiate agreements and debate policy. It's also a source of knowledge and information, and promotes many different kinds of initiatives that have its same scope. One of these was a panel discussion I attended this week, aiming for greater appreciation of local crops. The event was organized by the Global Facilitation Unit for Underutilized Species, an offspring of Bioversity, which is an international agricultural research institute whose mandate is to conserve biodiversity for future generations. Sounds rather technical, doesn't it? But actually, it's not. Irmgard Hirschle-Zeledon, who's the lady behind it, says Bioversity has a very hands-on approach.
Conserving doesn't mean only to protect the species in gene banks and keep them artificially conserved there, but conserve biodiversity through its utilization.
Why is that so important?
Future generations, they must have a basis of living, and biodiversity is the asset everywhere available, even to poor people, on which they can resort in order to have access to food, to shelter, to energy, and so on. And biodiversity is the basis of future plant breeding efforts.
Now, Irmgard is clearly referring to agricultural diversity, but she explained there are in fact three general kinds of biodiversity: habitat diversity, genetic diversity, and species diversity. The survival of each is linked to the health of the other two, and together they comprise the wealth of ecosystems in our universe. Ultimately, that's why the preservation of biodiversity in our changing world is so important. Irmgard and her team operate in the field of agriculture, and more precisely in that of neglected or underutilized crop species. I asked her to explain what underutilized species are.
That is a very open term, and it is interpreted in different ways. In our context, we say underutilized species are species that have a potential which is not yet fully exploited to improve food security, reduce poverty, and improve livelihoods of poor people.
For example, what is an underutilized species that we can pinpoint?
Many traditional plants that have been used in the past to a great extent are now not so much used anymore. They have been replaced by modern crops. An example is, for instance, many African indigenous vegetables, which have been replaced by cabbage or tomatoes or onions. And these vegetables, for instance, are indigenous eggplants, amaranthus, which is a leafy vegetables, but also in other parts of the world, like in South America, we have the Andean grains, such as quinoa, which is also called the Inca wheat, or amaranthus, two small grains which have been almost completely replaced by imported wheat. And they are now experiencing a kind of revival because people have realized that they have been very nutritious to them, and so therefore the people have been much healthier than they are now with their diets based on wheat, on pasta, and introduced food varieties.
And that's not their only value.
Also, these species have been selected over centuries to resist adverse conditions where they are growing. So they hardly need any external inputs like fertilizers and pesticides to grow and to still provide reasonable yields. So in, for instance, in drought periods, these species also not providing the highest yields, like high-yielding maize varieties in a good year, they resist the drought and still give people some food to survive.
But that's only the introduction to the program. Just to put the panel discussion I want to tell you about into context. The first panelist I spoke to is Jeff McNeely, a scientist at the World Conservation Union in Switzerland. I asked him why it is important in this day and time to raise awareness for underutilized crop species.
I think that when we say underutilized species, we immediately get people thinking the wrong thing. And I think what we're really talking about is diversity and trying to encourage the use of crops that people have been using for hundreds, thousands of years even, and encouraging them to continue to use these species. I don't think it's a terribly technical issue either. You know, I think if we go around the world and we see the 6,000 or 7,000 different cultures, you'll find that they're all eating something that's slightly different. And I think what we've been arguing here today is to maintain that kind of diversity so that the world is a richer place for everybody on the planet.
So in the face of climate change, maybe?
Well, climate is certainly going to change. And by having this kind of diversity, we've increased our capacity to adapt to the kinds of changes that are certain to come.
The chairman of the panel, FAO's Dr. Eric Kuhnemann, has a slightly different perspective.
A lot of our food system today is based on relatively few crops. And there are huge opportunities and needs to diversify this, not only for income of producers, but also to improve the diet and for nutritional reasons, including address problems of the double burden of malnutrition, not only the lack of proper nutrients for undernutrition, but also people eating too much of the wrong sorts of thing and creating diabetes and other non-communicable diseases associated with diet.
So it's important not only in the developing countries, but also in the rich nations.
Yes, absolutely true. And in fact, there are many programs in North America and Europe promoting, say, five a day, encouraging people to expand the consumption of fruits and vegetables for the same sorts of goals. But there are many underutilized species that could contribute to this effort as well.
Listening to the speakers, I discovered that over 50% of the global requirement for proteins and calories are met by maize, wheat, and rice. And yet it was highlighted there are more than 7,000 plant species across the world that are cultivated or harvested from the wild for food. Dr. Rick Kush-Leyenga of the UN's Biotrade Promotion Programme, UNCTAD, has made the promotion of underutilized species one of his main aims.
What kind of impact can they have on our society today?
They are at this moment as an input for food, they're an input for building materials, they're an input for medicine. They are used at this moment. They're at the basis of everything we do, species in general. Yeah, but the number of species we are using is getting more and more limited, and we only focus on those that are most commercially available. And here today we've been talking about how we can try to take into account those foods or those species that are not necessarily commercially used, big cash crops, and how we can start making use of those to give value to them, and if we give value to them, to use to support their survival in the future. It's very much underutilized species for me is very much a concept linked to biodiversity, which is something that is more and more known. Everybody talks about climate change at this moment, but the issue of biodiversity is going to be the second big issue in the world, and underutilized species are all related to the concept of biodiversity.
I forgot to mention that the room the discussion took place in was full of delegates from all over the world. Men and women from Nigeria, Jamaica, Tanzania, Japan, Egypt, Canada, just to name a few, had problems to expose and recommendations to make regarding the value of underutilized species. These will be synthesized in a report to be handed to the FAO Commission on Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture. I asked all those I spoke to what their hopes are for the near future.
My hope is, first of all, that the Commission now this week in some way reflects in their report, in their recommendations, what has been discussed here at this meeting, that this will translate at the long run into a change of policies in the countries, into a change of attitude towards these species in the member countries, and that also this discussion from here gets to the notice of some donors who will then rethink or think about providing continuous support for either for us or for any other new unit that should come up to support the countries in working on underutilized species and utilizing them.
Well, I hope that there will be a lot more interest paid by governments in maintaining this kind of cultural diversity and agricultural diversity so that they have a broader base of crops upon which to build the future.
And also for food security, I assume.
Yes, I think that we will have a lot more food security if we are more self-reliant, if we're able to feed ourselves and then export a surplus. But if we depend on food from somewhere else all the time, then we're in a very vulnerable situation.
What I hope is that the issue of biodiversity becomes more important, that in our daily lives we can start paying attention more to this issue through very practical ways, by starting to use it more, by starting to pay attention to those species that are local to our region, to our habitats, but also species that come from abroad, and that we can not just focus on the 1, 2, 3, 4 species we all know.
It's a way of tackling food security in the world as well.
It's a way of tackling food security, and it's a way of tackling biodiversity conservation in the long run. They all go together. You cannot separate from one from the other. And now with climate change, there's going to be much more pressure on these type of species.
I think we would all hope that we would manage this planet in a more responsible way, including what we grow and how we grow it. And good agriculture practices and diversification of the production systems in responsible ways, I think, are goals for all of us to address the Millennium Development Goals in the UN system.
So next time you come across finger millet, teff, pili or peach palm, don't brush them aside. Why not try them out instead of your usual wheat or maize? Not only will you be promoting their utilization and their trade, you'll also be treating yourself to a healthy meal which is low in fat and high in fiber. And more important, you'll be making your own tiny contribution to help local economies, to conserve traditional knowledge, and to protect the very precious biodiversity that is an integral part of God's creation. And now Father Jim Brand, Spiritual Director of the Pontifical Beda College, talks to those who are sad or depressed, reminding them that God is always there, even through the harshest of winters.
Hello, it's Father Jim again, once again. When I was a child, because my surname began with B, I sat in the front row of the first little school I was at when I was 6. And Mrs. Long, who was the headmaster's wife, and he was a terrifying man, he used to cane us. She used to teach us poetry by rote, of course, rather than by heart. And because I was in the front row, she used to use my head and bang my head with a ruler so that we kept in time. And this put me off poetry to start with. We used to say, by the shores of Gitchigumi, by the shining Big Sea water stood the wigwam of Nokomis, daughter of the moon Nokomis. Well, you can see it stuck. But I used to find Catholic hymns were like that. By the cross of station keeping stood the mournful mother weeping to the last. And it's only since I left school I came to love poetry. Because poetry is able to say things that prose can't always say. It speaks to the heart and feelings as well as the head. I remember at school, the main school I was at, if you were naughty, you had to write out lines. Either I must be on time at class or something like that 100 times. Or they'd give us someone's poem to write out. Well, I tell you, if I was a poet, I would be so angry that my work of art was used as a punishment. I mean, it's outrageous. It's enough to put anyone off poetry. Well, since then, I've come to love poetry. But poetry is really to be heard, not just read. And I often wonder whether I'm worthy of broadcasting another person's work of art. I know a famous actor like Sir Laurence Olivier used to have butterflies in the wings of the stage before he went on to perform Hamlet. In other words, he didn't just say, oh, it's another matinee socket to them. He used to ponder the mystery of the character that is Hamlet. So it's with great diffidence I dare quote poetry, especially Shakespeare. If it's not up to the mark, I trust you'll forgive me. At least I'm going to do my best. Hamlet was sometimes very depressed and had an idea of human beings that were negative. And here's one of his statements. I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth, forgone all custom of exercises, and indeed it goes so heavily with my disposition that this goodly frame, the earth, seems to me a sterile promontory. This most excellent canopy, the air, look you, this brave overhanging firmament, this majestical roof fretted with golden fire, why, it appears no other thing to me than a foul and pestilent congregation of vapours. What a piece of work is a man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form and moving, how express and admirable, in action, how like an angel, in apprehension, how like a god, the beauty of the world, the paragon of animals, and yet, to me, what is this quintessence of dust? Man delights not me. No, nor woman neither, though by your smiling you seem to say so. Poor Hamlet. He'd listened to what everyone else had told him about the beauty of a human being and the creation. He was in a bad mood. So I'd like to speak today to those who are feeling depressed or in a bad mood. We all have seasons. We go through winters and summers. Sometimes we're at our heights and sometimes at our depths. Let's try and remember God is always there. Praise to the holiest in the height. And in the depths be praise. Real life isn't all summer. There are harsh winters. But if we feel we're going through a harsh winter, don't expect to produce strawberries. Sometimes people scold themselves because they're not producing strawberries. No strawberries in January in the Northern Hemisphere. It's all right. It's all right to be fallow. It's all right not to have blossom, not to have sap shooting, not to produce fruit. Because in winter, an amazing thing happens. There's nothing to be seen, but below ground level, in the soil, a miracle is happening. Otherwise, as T.S. Eliot said in Murder in the Cathedral, we'll only have a sour spring. So if you're feeling down, just be there and let the Lord come and kiss you better in your own time. And whatever you do, don't listen to people who tell you to cheer up. That's our problem. We can't when we're down. We need someone who'll be willing just to accept us where we are and how we're feeling. And that is the Holy Spirit, the Comforter. The Holy Spirit comes to us just where we're at, high or low, summer or winter, night or day. He is our companion. So you might find this little poem by the famous American poet Longfellow. It's called A Psalm of Life. Tell me not in mournful numbers life is but an empty dream. For the soul is dead that slumbers, and things are not what they seem. Life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. Dust thou art, to dust returnest, was not spoken of the soul. Not enjoyment and not sorrow is our destined end or way, but to act, that each tomorrow find us farther than today. Art is long, and time is fleeting, and our hearts, though stout and brave, still, like muffled drums, are beating funeral marches to the grave. In the world's broad field of battle, in the bivouac of life, be not like dumb, driven cattle, be a hero in the strife. Trust no future, however pleasant. Let the dead past bury their dead. Act, act in the living present, heart within and God o'erhead. Lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime, and departing, leave behind us footprints on the sand of time. Footprints that perhaps another, sailing o'er life's solemn main, a forlorn and shipwrecked brother, seeing, shall take heart again. Let us then be up and doing, with a heart for any fate, still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labour and to wait. To me, that is a wonderful poem about the sacrament of the present moment. Let the past go, let the future see to itself. I am with you, says the Lord. Present indicative, present tense. Today, I am with you. Amen.
Laudetur Jesus Christus.